Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is the fourth of 11 conversations with former Secretary of State George Shultz and economist David Friedman. Originally recorded in 2006, the talk dives into the world of ideas, including personal experiences each have had in their own lives. We hope you enjoy the talk, and be sure to check back each week for a new episode of the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Hello, I'm delighted to have a chance to talk with you. And I was in particular curious about your view over your lifetime of ways in which the world has changed. And that it seemed to me that I can observe what seemed to me two changes in opposite directions, one of which I like and one of which I don't like. That on the one hand, I think the sort of intuitive force of belief in private property and ideas like that has gone down. That 50 years ago, saying, you can't do that, it's violating his property rights, felt like a real argument. And to most people, unfortunately, nowadays, it doesn't. And at the same time, it seems to me that belief in socialism has also gone down. That 50 years ago, a whole lot of educated, thoughtful, intelligent people thought that the way to solve problems was to have the government decide what ought to be done and tell people to do it. And that view has very largely fallen out of repute since. And I was wondering, since you've got a longer time horizon from a different perspective than I do, what your view was about those changes.
Well, I was born in 1920, and I began to be aware of things maybe 10 years later or so. So we had an emergence of government activity during the Depression, so-called New Deal era, when suddenly government took on, they didn't call it socialism, but a lot of the attributes in which government was responsible for you rather than you're responsible for yourself. And so you saw that wave, and then, of course, it's gone the other direction.
But hasn't there
also... post-World War II period.
Yeah. But hasn't there also been a continuing change in perceptions? That is, if I see this largely through arguing with people online, and there are certain arguments which seem intuitively persuasive to me, and which it seems to me would have been persuasive 60 or 70 years ago to most people, and that many of the people I interact with, you know, it's as if I was talking gibberish, and arguments which come down to individuals should be free to decide what to do with themselves, with their property, whether or not you like the decision. And there have been lots of different ways in which that moral intuition, it seems to me, has been eroded away, at least, you know, from my very limited perspective.
I think you're right. Property rights are not what they used to be, even in places that believe in them as we believe in them in the United States. Stanford University.
Mm-hmm.
Here we are. And Leland Stanford willed, I think, 8,300 acres. Mm-hmm. That's his farm. That's why they call it the farm. Mm-hmm. But now, to use any of that land, it's almost impossible because it's Stanford's private property, but the community has kind of adopted it. And in order to do anything, to build a new house or a road or something, you have to get the town's permission and the county's permission. And they're very difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
In effect, Stanford's private property has been eroded.
Yeah. The figure I've heard for the whole Bay Area is that between 80 and 90% of the land cannot be used for housing because of legal restrictions at some level of government, ranging all the way down from, I suppose, federal park down to local zoning rules.
But there's a lot of housing. There was a man called Akramayoff. He was the chief, the equivalent of our chief of staff in the Soviet Union, Marshal Akramayoff. And I got to know him in the days when I was negotiating with the Soviet Union. And we always knew when he showed up, it was going to be a serious session because they had to clear everything with the military. Anyway, he came out here after I left office and visited me, stayed at my house. He's a very interesting guy, smart and observant. So the first thing that happened was the military provided a helicopter, and we took a long ride over the Bay Area. And it was a lovely day, and little clouds over the Golden Gate Bridge, and it was really pretty. And we landed, and I sort of waited quietly to see what his reaction was. And he said, "It's a beautiful area, but what impresses me is what you have done with it." I said, "What do you mean by that?" He said, "So many houses." and a lot of houses with swimming pools. It just blew him away. So there are a lot of houses.
But there are a lot fewer houses and a lot higher housing prices than if large amounts of land weren't being kept off the market. But I was thinking actually less of the legal changes, where I think you're right that there has been a general shift. At the same time, we believe less in central planning, we in a certain sense do more of it, that is have. But I was thinking more nearly about how people think and, you know, about what our friend Adam Smith called moral sentiments. And it seems to me that the argument of the form, he shouldn't do that, but he's entitled to, because it's him, has to a significant degree broken down in persuasiveness. And, well, not sure I know why, but
to some extent, I think you're right.
But so, what are the other changes? If you think,
I think the big changes that you, physical changes you see, is how easy it is to communicate now, everywhere in the world, how quickly.
You know, that's right. Many
of how easy it is to get around.
Sure. Some of
my people speak of a shrinking world, and it's true. It literally has shrunk.
Some of my political arguments are with people who are, in fact, in Germany or in England at the moment, and we're arguing online, and it doesn't matter to me where they are, except that it gives me a somewhat different perspective. I was curious, you were mentioning the Soviet Union, and given what we now know, it's at least tempting to say that we were really wrong during much of the Cold War period, in the sense that we greatly overestimated the power of the opposition, that the Soviet Union was in a sense running a fairly extended bluff. And you probably know Warren Nutter gave very different estimates of Soviet economy than everybody else, and it now looks as though he was right. And I'm curious, if you look back at that time, sort of to what extent were we being fooled by their pretense to be sort of an economy almost equal to ours, and to what extent did we have it right?
Well, I think some people were fooled. I never put much stock by all those estimates. I didn't try to make alternative estimates myself, but I had been there enough to see how shoddy much of what was there was.
Yeah.
And so I couldn't believe that they were that powerful an economy. On the other hand, they had nuclear-tipped ballistic missiles that could wipe us out. And that you had to take seriously.
That they did.
There was no bluff.
Sure. But part of our concern...
And they also had the ability, being the kind of state they were, to make those missiles mobile, which made them very much harder to take out.
Sure. But at least part, if I remember sort of as at ground level, sort of at the same period, what people were talking about. And part of the concern was the idea that if you had eliminated the nuclear weapons, the Soviets would just roll over Western Europe. Yeah. And I'm wondering if maybe we were wildly wrong, if maybe, in a sense, the first Iraq War is the version of what would have happened. Now, of course, our military was probably in better shape by then than it was back in the 1960 or whatever. But
well,
if in
know, conventional forces, they had superior numbers of tanks and people and so on, and that troubled people. But it always seemed to me, particularly you look at what happened in Afghanistan, that the Soviet fighter is fabled when fighting for the motherland on his own turf, but never did so well outside that.
Yeah.
And I can remember when I took office, one of my longtime friends was the Chancellor of West Germany, Helmut Schmidt. And so I had a long talk with Helmut, and he said, you should stop your people from all these wild claims about Soviet strength. He said, I'll put one German soldier up against 10 Soviets any day when they're fighting on German soil. Hmm. And so he didn't buy, and I, in the end, I didn't really buy it either. But you had to... pay attention to those missiles.
You're talking about your friendship with various people raises a question that's always intrigued me when I read the newspapers. And that is that one hears reports about, you know, the president has met with Tony Blair or has met with the president of France or whoever the current ruler of the Soviet Union is. And I'm never sure whether something is really going on there or whether all such meetings are simply publicity, photo ops. And what's really going on is negotiating by people who, unlike the typical president, actually know the details of the particular place and time and issues and have the time to spend doing it. I mean, is the personal element really that important?
I think it's important. Well, I watched President Reagan very closely. And President Reagan drove his staff crazy because he'd be meeting some major leader. And he didn't pay that much attention to all the stuff that he was supposed to be talking about. And there was a simple reason. In the meeting, what he was doing was taking the measure of the person that he was meeting with. What kind of person is this? And he loved a person that had a sense of humor. You could feel a human side. And so his initial meetings were always kind of that nature. But when you have these big meetings, what they do is energize everybody to be working on the issues. And so a lot of attention is paid to them. And then a sort of tone is set. Is our job to create problems, or is our job to try to solve the problem, what problems we can? Makes a big difference.
Does knowing the other person have a sense of humor matter? That is, I presume that there must have been, you know, murderous tyrants and aggressive rulers who had good senses of humor. And so what is really, if you take the case, because it's sort of an interesting question, if you take the case where where Reagan meets with somebody important, chief of another state, does Reagan in fact learn, or does the other person learn, things about the person that really matter for policy? Do you learn, can you trust him, or do you just learn, well, he's very persuasive?
No, well, you learn that you can talk to him. That's the first thing. Have a conversation that is not simply repeating things that you're supposed to say. He'll listen and react to what you say. So that's an initial thing that I think happens. And Reagan was very good at that. I remember we had a meeting with the head of Mozambique, and his name is escaping me. But Mozambique was a country in the Soviet orbit. And we thought it was a country we could wean away from them. Margaret Thatcher also agreed with that. And that always impressed Ronald Reagan when Margaret thought something could happen. But the first meeting was wildly controversial. Why in the world is the president meeting with his head of this communist-inclined country? Michelle was the man's name. Anyway, he came in and turned out to be a very personable guy. He had spent a lot of time in Moscow. He started telling the president anti-Soviet jokes. They were really funny. And of course, Reagan enjoyed that, and they began to hit it off better. And it set a tone, and we were then able to do things in Mozambique to improve their agriculture and do one thing or another that gradually did shift the gears. So it wasn't that the meeting itself and understanding tilted things, but it set a tone,
but
it gave an attitude that we can try and we'll see.
Is what's really going on that Reagan is persuading this person, I'm not the sort of guy who'll dump you next year when it's convenient? Is it the question of the predictability of the people of the head of governments? Because if that's it, then democracy is at a great disadvantage since people don't stay at the head of government very long.
No, but some people stay a while. And Reagan did establish the reputation of somebody who was good for his word. And I saw that on display on a couple of occasions. The first deal that we made in the Reagan administration with the Soviets was a human rights deal. And it involved the Pentecostals. Remember, this was a group that rushed into our embassy in the Carter administration. They were still there when the Reagan administration came in. And for fortuitous reasons, I had a dinner with the president and Nancy. I'd been in China, and it was a trip with lots of publicity. It turned out to be very constructive. Things happened, and they watched it. And on the Friday that we came back, it snowed in Washington, and it snowed Saturday. And the president couldn't get to Camp David. Helicopter couldn't go. Cars couldn't go. So our phone rings Saturday morning, and he invites my wife and I to come over and have supper with him. So the four of us sat down, and he asked about the China trip, and then I'd had experience with Soviet leaders during the Nixon administration, so he was talking about that. And I could see that he was dying to meet with these people. And then it dawned on me that he had never met with any big-time communist leader. So by that time, I had established weekly meetings with Ambassador de Brinon, and our idea was, let's find little irritants and deal with them. And in the process, we can walk before we try to run. Anyway, I said to him, next Tuesday, de Brinon's coming over for one of those meetings. If you'd like, I'll just put him in a car and bring him over here, and you can talk to him yourself. So he liked that idea. His White House staff didn't like it. They didn't trust him. But over de Brinon came, and President Reagan said, he'll only be here about 10 minutes, because I just want to tell him that if his new boss, was then Andropov, wants to have a constructive discussion, I'm ready for it. Won't take me any time. Well, we must have been there an hour and a half. We went through everything under the sun. And President Reagan came down very hard on the human rights side of things. And he pointed to these Pentecostals in our embassy. He said, look at that, it's an eyesore. Everybody can see that, it's ridiculous. And all it means is that you don't let people worship as they choose, and you don't let them immigrate if they want to. And it's terrible. So writing back, de Brinon says, and President Reagan kept adding, all I want is to get him out. You get him out, I won't say a word. So de Brinon says to me, let's make that our project. And so a couple of weeks later, over comes a memorandum from the Soviets that I had to take to the president and say, Mr. President, this is obviously a response, but any lawyer could drive a truck through this thing. There's nothing. So we improved it a little bit, but finally got the Pentecostals, decided to try to get them out of the embassy, which they did.
Meaning and getting them out of the country, or?
They had to, first they had to get out of the embassy, so you had to trust that they wouldn't be killed. And then they let them out about 3 months later, with their families, about 60 people. And Reagan never said anything. The deal was, you let them out and I won't crow.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So, can you imagine a president strong enough not to crow under those circumstances? Yeah. And then I watched him, do you remember Bitburg? It was when Kohl, who was then the Chancellor of Germany, was in Washington. He said to President Reagan, there was a meeting between me and Mitterrand, the French president at the time, in a cemetery where French and German soldiers were buried. And we had a big handshake, and it made a big difference all around in our country. And how about when you come to Germany, we'll visit a cemetery and have the same thing happen, where Americans and Germans. So President Reagan agreed. And then the Germans proposed a cemetery called Bitburg. And Mike Deaver went over, and the graves were covered with snow, and he looked around and looked okay to him. And of course, then the press went and investigated Bitburg, and they dusted everything off, and they found that there were SS buried there. And why is the president going? And Elie Wiesel came to the White House, and he said, Mr. President, your place is not with the SS, your place is with the victims of the SS. And so on. It was a huge amount of pressure. And Reagan said, I promised Kohl I would go. And there are all sorts of alternatives, and we displayed them to Kohl, and he wouldn't change. So in the end, we went to a Holocaust place, and it was a very short visit, but he carried through. And I remember Margaret Thatcher and probably lots of other heads of government said, I would never have done that. But Ronald Reagan gave his word, and Kohl should have let him off, but he didn't, and he went. So there's a man whose word you can take,
but there,
and put it in the bank.
But there is also a real limit to democratic systems, because his word becomes useless, becomes worthless once he's not president anymore. I mean, still worth something, but it's not worth anything for committing the country. And, I mean, it seems to me that one of the general restrictions of political systems, and especially, though not exclusively, democratic ones, is that they can't really sign long-term contracts, because you can't tie the hands of your successor.
To some extent, you can.
My standard example, not in international affairs, is the case of rent control. That you have a mayor rent controls apartments in a city because it's politically profitable to do that. One result is that people don't want to build apartment buildings in that city because they can't make money out of it.
Roofs or failings.
So the mayor, assuming the mayor is a clever guy, he says it's all right. Rent control only applies to buildings that already existed in 1960. New buildings are not controlled. And that looks as though it solves the problem. You now get your new construction. But the problem, of course, is that if the entrepreneur thinks about building a new building, he says, wait a minute. If in 1960 it was politically profitable to rent control the buildings that already existed, in 1970 it will be politically profitable to rent control the buildings built between 1960 and 1970 for the same reasons. Even if the mayor is an honest man, he probably won't be in office by 1970. So that even if the mayor really wants to exempt the new construction, he can't do it. And that's...
Yeah, but there's a problem with your argument.
Yep.
It's been demonstrated, and people have absorbed, that rent controls don't work very well.
Yes.
So all we have left in this country, I think, are some in New York and some in San Francisco.
Santa Monica, I think. Did Santa Monica
anyway,
abolish?
Anyway, they're very rare, because they don't work well. And there was a devastating article written by George Stigler and Milton Friedman. Mm-hmm. I think it was entitled Roofs or Ceilings or something
Correct.
Like that.
Mm-hmm.
That just took the argument apart at the seams.
Did you know?
And people believed it.
Did you know that Ayn Rand's response to that article was to conclude that the authors were communists?
Really?
if you read, it's very interesting. If you read Ayn Rand's letters, the person who compiled the letters either didn't know or didn't say who the authors of the article were. But Rand was absolutely furious. She attacked a close friend of hers who had been responsible for publishing it. At Fee.
What was her reasoning?
Oh, her argument was that they were accepting the moral position that it was all right to violate people's property rights if it accomplished a good purpose, and were merely saying, but it has bad consequences, and that was conceding the moral high side to the socialists. In addition, she objected to their using the term rationing to apply to the market's allocation as well as to government allocation. She wasn't entirely wrong. I mean, she had a point, but it was sort of typical of her.
Not a good point.
But it was typical of her that...
Because as I have absorbed Milton Friedman's lessons, it's all about freedom.
But that particular article, which was written very early, is not about freedom. It's about consequences.
Right.
And but anyway, I thought it was intriguing that you have people who in some sense are really on the same side.
Right.
And yet... From her standpoint, the fact that you use the wrong arguments, what she thinks are the wrong arguments, not only is a mistake, anybody could say that, it's a deliberate mistake. I mean, that was what's interesting, that if you read the letters, she's clearly claiming that these people she knows nothing about must really be closet Reds who are deliberately subverting the good pro-free market position by making the wrong arguments for it. I thought it was fascinating. I've told the guy who edited her letters what it was, and I'll be intrigued to see if he ever does another edition, whether he puts it in or whether he was deliberately concealing it so as not to make her look foolish. But it was... Rand was an interesting character. I mean, I often disagree with her, but at the same time find her sort of an admirably courageous and original woman. But I remember my father describing her appearance on a television show that he watched, where he was commenting that she was obviously out of the intellectual league of the other people there. And somebody said to her, "Miss Rand, it is said that your books are not in the mainstream of American literature." And Rand replied, "The mainstream of American literature is a stagnant swamp." That was a great line. But
yeah.
So what are the other, if you think about how things are different now than when you first became involved in political matters, what's changed in sort of the world, other than little details like the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Well, people who are of a color other than white are much more accepted in this country than they were.
Mm-hmm.
And I took part in that process to a mild extent. And I think we're much better off because of it. That's a big social change. Came about, well, peacefully except for the Civil War, but anyway.
Another big social, if you're talking about social changes, another big social change has been the large breakdown in marriage. the breakdown in sort of conventional, that 60 years ago, there were certainly unmarried people who were in fact living together and sleeping together. But in most communities, it was regarded as scandalous to admit it. Whereas now it's more or less routine. And there have been a bunch of...
It's not necessarily good.
I'm not saying good or bad.
I agree with you that there's a lot of it.
It's a large change, and it's
got... Some of these things are starting to be a swing of the pendulum in the other
Hard
direction,
to tell.
I think.
It's hard to tell. That is, and part of the question is why things changed. Was it just technology, just mm-hmm. better contraception, or are there other things going on? But it seems to me that if you're talking about large social changes, that's got to be one of the big ones.
Sure.
How about universities? You've been... some stages of your career involved in running universities.
Yes, well,
how have they changed?
Universities, during my time in universities, are dominated by disciplines. They're organized by disciplines. And disciplines are boundaries. And I think there is beginning to be some impatience with the boundaries and a tendency to see that some of the most interesting areas to delve into are overlaps between different disciplines.
Hasn't that always been true?
Well, I don't think so. I think there's been...
I mean, there was a...
There was a long period when you had big figures who weren't necessarily in universities, but they were the main... they were the main thinkers. Then I think it's fair to say at the turn of the century, universities emerged and disciplines emerged in a very formal sense. And the disciplines are the property of the people in that discipline. And it can be very fierce.
I was thinking that for my field, which is economic analysis of law, that that particular boundary was being broken by what, the early 60s or late 50s?
Oh, yeah, sure.
At Chicago.
Well, the Chicago program in law and economics
yeah,
was
sure.
an example, an early example yeah. of the breaking through of these disciplines.
If you go back further, your point about the establishment of the universities, something that struck me a long time ago, I think I've discussed it somewhere or other in writing, is that if you look at the originators of various academic fields, Darwin was trained as a clergyman. So was Malthus. Ricardo was a retired stock market speculator. One of the people who founded geology was a gentleman farmer. Another was a mining engineer.
You're making my point.
The interesting thing is that if you go back to about the 18th and maybe early 19th century, you have essentially amateurs as the people who largely, not entirely, but largely create fields. And starting, I would have said, by late 19th century, and certainly by the 20th, almost entirely you're having it done by professionals.
Right.
And I've wondered if you're going to have a reverse of that, not because of interdisciplinary movements, but because the combined effect of rising real incomes, which mean that more and more people can do serious scholarly work as a hobby, so to speak, because they can afford it, and the better communication technology, which means, like, take a real case. There's a extremely smart man who used to work for NASA, and his hobby was inventing economic institutions. And he came up with this quite clever idea of using markets deliberately to generate information, what are called idea futures. Robin Hanson is his name. And I was corresponding with him at that point, or by email. I hadn't even met him. I eventually met him. But he was, I don't know what he was trained as, a mathematician or something like that, something not in economics. But he was bright and he was interested in economics. And he's now a professor of economics at George Mason. But he did his original, in some sense, path-breaking work on idea futures back before he was officially an economist. He went back to school and got a PhD in economics. But I think that there's a real tendency. One of my hobbies is medieval cooking. And I'm not trained as a historian, but I'm interested in it. It's fun to take a recipe out of a book written in the 13th century and see if you can make it taste good. And I think there's an increasing tendency in this society to have amateurs. I think astronomers, I believe, make a good deal of use of amateur assistants. And I think historians are beginning to interact with people who do historical recreation, of whom the best are doing serious scholarship, though most of it is just play. So I wonder if maybe we're going to see a reversal, not because of the interdisciplinary element, but because of the rise, open source software is in a sense a similar pattern where you're having a sophisticated computer software operating system, Linux, being created in effect as a hobby by a whole bunch of volunteers. So that would be a very interesting change if it keeps happening, if we move to a world where we've again got the equivalents of Malthus and Ricardo and people like that making new ideas.
I think you're writing off too easily the potential impact of interdisciplinary work. Hmm. That is, if you start with disciplines and you see the boundaries overlapping and you try to do something about it, apparently some really good results can come.
For example,
I have a friend here at Stanford who is a brilliant biologist. Her name is Lucy Shapiro. Hmm. And Stanford has recently created something they call BioX. So there's this big building.
Bio what?
BioX.
Yes.
So here's this big building, and the people in it are physicists and engineers and medical doctors and biologists. And every time I see Lucy, when she's come back from being there all morning, sometimes she isn't. She's just in a state of euphoria because she has had things come to her attention that never occurred to her. She finds it extremely stimulating. And it isn't only sort of the intellectual aspects of it. It's that a physicist has equipment and a way of going about investigating something that is different from the biological sciences. And you look at that and you say, maybe I can use that and move myself. So there are all kinds of ways in which, at least as I listen to these people, they're getting benefits from what people are at least calling interdisciplinary research.
But let me suggest.
But all these people are very good in their discipline to begin
with.
But
I don't think this is.
They bring something to the party.
I don't think this is new. Look, think about John von Neumann. Von Neumann was a mathematician.
Yeah, there.
His work on game theory has played, I would say, too high a role in modern economics, but certainly an important role in economics. His work was also related to modern physics. Also one of the founders of the ideas in modern computer theory. So it seems to me you've always had people working, in a sense, on the margins.
We had the Committee on Social Thought at the University of Chicago.
For a long time.
There are always things you can point to. But there is more momentum behind it right now.
Let me give another example of my...
But anyway, you asked how universities are changing, and
yes,
I think this is one way in which...
That you think
you're
they're becoming
starting to
more
see some change.
Because I have the feeling that people have talked about the virtues of interdisciplinary stuff forever.
But mostly it's been sloppy.
Yep.
But I think you're starting to see things that are, in a sense, disciplined. Hmm. That is, people set high standards and are producing interesting results.
It occurs to me that I have another example of my phenomenon of the sort of, the, in a sense, non-professional. And that's a couple of books, one of which I'm reading at the moment, by Judith Rich Harris, who's, I don't know if you know the story, she wrote a book called The Nurture Assumption, which I came across years ago and thought was just fascinating and gave all my friends for Christmas. But her thesis, which she gives a lot of evidence for, is that what determines human personality is indeed both genetics and environment, but that the relevant environment is not the family. That the relevant environment is the peer group for most people, and that therefore all the stuff psychologists have been saying for 50 or 80 years about how this style of child rearing produces this kind of person just was not supported by the data. And it turns out that she's somebody who got a master's at Harvard in psychology a long time ago, was told by her professor that she didn't have the makings of an academic. This was probably when women were much less commonly professors than they are now. So she left the academy, got married, had children, but kept a hand in by co-authoring textbooks, child development textbooks. And eventually doing that, she concluded that the orthodox views in the field were wrong. She wrote an article in one of the psychology journals, which got their prize for the best article of the year. And it turned out that the prize was named after the Harvard professor who told her she had no future in psychology. And it's a fascinating book, and she's just written another book I've just started reading that's fun. But that's a case of somebody who's really outside the academy, but thanks to email and other communication technologies, she's in touch with people all over the world, interesting people in a variety of fields, and the result is that she's doing what, as far as I can tell, is really first-rate thinking about interesting questions.
Right. But the position she's challenging has a long history.
Sure.
After all, the hand that rocks the cradle rules the world.
That's right. But she thinks the evidence generally doesn't support it, that there are exceptions, but that as a general rule, I mean, the basic argument's a neat argument.
I'll never forget when my mother died.
Uh-huh.
And most people,
uh-huh.
You lose your mother and it's a big...
But
because your mother is the one person in the world who is totally unambiguously, no matter what, on your side.
Sure. But the question is, would you have been a significantly different personality if your mother had been a different sort of person? Or if your mother had raised you differently? And at least the evidence she offers is that most people wouldn't have been. Not that there are no exceptions, but that that's the usual pattern. That essentially...
Well, I think mothers are important.
I'm sure mothers are important in a variety of ways. But her argument, at least, is that human beings are good at realizing that different rules apply in different environments, and that the kid who behaves in one way at home is a different person with his peers, and that for most people it's the peer version of you that grows into the adult, because as the adult you're not in your family anymore, you're interacting with other people. Anyway, it's in, my real point, though, is just that there are some interesting examples, and I think Linux is one, Judith Harris's work is another, the whole blogosphere would be a third example, where you're getting serious intellectual developments outside of the standard model of disciplines and universities and all the rest of it. And that seems to me one of the intriguing things about the century we're now.
I suppose you'd say universities are less dominant as centers of thought than they once were.
I think that's probably right. And I think, though I'm not sure, I think they'll become increasingly less dominant. Because, look, it used to be that if you wanted to interact regularly with really smart people, you had to be at Chicago or Harvard or a couple of other people in the academic context. Nowadays, you could be at Podunk U, and as long as you're smart enough so they want to talk to you, you can use the modern communication technologies, and people do. I mean, that was my example of Robin Hanson, who's a really neat guy, and therefore people are happy to talk to him because he says interesting things. And I think that's true of Judith Harris, and I suspect there are probably 100 other people who feel that I haven't touched of whom the same thing is true. So I think that, I mean, I'm intrigued with the future.
Future's going to be different.
I have a book manuscript up on the web, on my website, called Future Imperfect, in which I explore possible futures, and I think it's an intriguing subject. But in any case, thank you very much for your insights into, what, the last 86 years of history, I guess, roughly, since you were born, and especially the last 50 or so since you were active in the world. And what you've told us.
Thank you.